I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. It's 4:37. Members present are everyone. Representatives Carrick, Colomb, Burke, Fields, Hall, Nelson, and Sadler. We have a few items on the agenda. First, we're going to revisit Senate Bill 79 by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. We also have HB 184, HB 20, HB 197, and HB 145. We'll see how far we get. So on Senate Bill 79, we adopted a CS for the bill last Friday.
Is it your intention to work through the entire agenda or to go up to the 5:15 ordinary adjournment time?
Well, Representative Hall will have to go back to another committee here after a little bit, so we'll just see how far we can get, okay? First up is Senate Bill 79. We adopted a CS for this bill last Friday and adopted an amendment subsequent to that. We received a fiscal note, so we're going to return to that to try to address some of the issues raised by the fiscal note. So with that, Madam Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
I move to rescind previous action and reporting SB 79 out of committee.
Is there objection?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Sadler?
Can I have an explanation as a reason for the rescission?
Sure.
To make her the motion, I suppose?
Oh, sure.
Yes. The reason to rescind is to consider the CS, an amendment to the CS.
Just for clarification, we're hoping to get back to which version?
If you want to answer that.
Through the co-chair, the version that we passed out of committee, version...
And I might add, Representative Sadler, rescinding action on passing the bill out of committee does not reverse action taken to adopt either N.4 or the CS that we adopted on Friday. The action before us is simply passing the bill out of committee.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I did not actually hear you. Which version are we getting back to, Representative Hall?
Through the co-chair, Representative Sadler, we're going back to version N.
Thank you, ma'am, and thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yep. Okay, is the objection maintained? Representative Sadler.
Sure, go ahead.
What's that?
No, the objection is not maintained.
Okay. So we have the version in our working document. We previously adopted N.4. That has not been rescinded. Does Senator Bjorkman and his staff want to join us at the table? Thank you, Senator Bjorkman and Ms. Bieber. I'm going to now move Amendment 2 N.5.
Do you object? I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Representative Hall. And the purpose of this amendment is to establish a higher threshold of bank assets that address some of the prospect of unintended consequences identified by Division Director Schmidt. And some of the public testimony from the last meeting, Senator Bjorkman, would you like to address this amendment as well?
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Fields, Co-Chair Hall, and members of the esteemed House Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you very much for having us back before your committee as well to make sure that this bill addresses some concerns brought forward by our smaller financial institutions in this state who had some unintended impacts of possibly being encouraged to be federally chartered instead of state charter. The number here in this amendment is designed and it has the intent of making sure that our state banks will not have a force that pushes them toward federally chartering, and thus that would cost our treasury through fees that the Division of Banking and Securities collects to lose money. So essentially, by putting in place a number which will protect our smaller financial institutions in this state, we can target this bill to other groups that would be most responsible for interchange fees that are taking away profits from bars, restaurants, and other retailers when it comes to taxes and tips, which really this is all about. So seeking to save money for our local businesses and local wait staff who are currently having their revenue eaten into by these interchange fees.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. And I would add that Dan Swanson and Brennan Duckett from the National Restaurant Association are online. So after hearing some of the testimony from local financial institutions and the division director, we did consult with counsel from the National Restaurant Association to try to address that. So do members have questions for either Dan Swanson or Brennan Duckett with the National Restaurant Association or Senator Bjorkman? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for the maker of the motion.
Sure.
The $10 billion, who does that cover and who does that not cover? I don't travel in big dollar banking circles, so I'm not quite sure who that covers and who that would cover in Alaska.
Let's see. Well, this will so I am going to be offering a conceptual amendment to raise that threshold to 20 because Credit Union One, just for example, has assets of 12. So the initial number was a little bit too low. We'll be adjusting that. And if is there further discussion, I can move that conceptual amendment whenever people want to take that up.
Actually, my question would still stand. Please, what was the number attempted to cover?
The number, like Senator Bjorkman said, is designed to avoid unintended consequences of forcing state chartered banks to seek federal charter, mm-hmm. Which would have negative fiscal implications for the state. Yes.
So I'm just trying to find out, again, not being a big dollar banking guy, are there any banks operating in Alaska that are more than $10 billion of assets according to the language here?
Well, there are, and that's why we're going to bump it up a little bit. I don't know the assets of every bank in the state.
I'm not seeking to, through the chair, I'm not seeking to get everyone just an example just for purposes of illustration.
Sure. Credit Union One has $12 billion in assets, is my understanding.
Okay. So. And is that the only one? But okay, that's good enough for illustration. Great, thanks.
Representative Blum.
Yeah, so that was kind of my concern. I want to be sure that the banks that we're trying to protect are all under this threshold, so I would support raising it. I guess I wanted to ask Senator Bjorkman, this has been my concern all along. The other piece of this, though, is if you exempt the smaller banks, the competitive advantage still is a problem, right? So if they don't if one side charges fees and the other doesn't charge fees, it still has a competitive problem, correct? Or because this is exempting them from the interchange fees, correct? Like they can charge interchange fees because they're smaller, right?
Through the chair to Representative Cologne. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
I don't pretend to be a legal scholar on the Uniform Banking Act, mm-hmm. But through conversations with national partners that specialize in this issue, this is the remedy that they suggested to ensure that the legislation before us has the intended effect of minimizing transaction fees that are incurred by merchants who have and collect sales tax and mm-hmm. also have transaction fees applied to tips.
Okay. And one other question. I don't
yes.
know if either one of you guys know this, but do you know if Global Credit Union is under 20 million?
Go ahead, Senator Bjorkman.
Through the chair to Representative Cologne, it's my understanding that the credit union with a large amount of assets is in fact Global Credit Union and not Credit Union One. Mm-hmm. I was told that by Mr. Sullivan earlier this afternoon. So that's the information I have. Yes, sir.
So they wouldn't be under the protection.
Go ahead, Senator Bjorkman.
Yes, ma'am. So through the chair to Representative Cologne, Global Credit Union has about $12 billion in assets. They would be protected by this amendment. Yes, ma'am.
And I apologize that I misspoke about which one.
Okay.
Representative Sadler.
Is Mr. Schmidt from the Division of Corporations, Banking, and Securities available to ask him that question just to get a more definitive answer as to who would be covered by this and who would not?
I believe he is. Mr. Schmidt, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Global Credit Union is actually one of the very largest credit unions in the country. I do not have at my fingertips their assets and whether they would fall under a $20 billion threshold or not. The state chartered banks, Northrim, Denali State Bank, Mount McKinley State Bank, and First Bank, all would fall below a $10 billion threshold. Okay. It is further my understanding that Credit Union One, the only state chartered credit union, would also fall below a $10 billion threshold.
Okay.
Can I ask
Director? Go ahead, Representative
Klum. Director Schmidt, do you have any just general insights on the amendment? I mean, I'm looking for any unintended consequences with this. Do you have any thoughts about it?
I have concerns relative to the implementation of this bill when it becomes law. It will require the various people in the credit card payment ecosystem to get new data that they don't already collect. It would require implementation of these across the approximately 10,000 banks worldwide that issue credit cards, utilizing the process for a merchant to send data to the credit card payment processor would involve many, many different banks across the world. For example, consider how many different credit cards are used in a single cruise ship sailing from what different countries. I am concerned that the publicly available data indicates that there's 320 credit card transactions Alaska per minute. That's based on a Google search. The division does not have access to, we do not regulate credit cards as such, so we don't have access to any higher quality information. If that works out to over 19,000 transactions in an hour, and with a $1,000 statutory penalty, that means in a worst case scenario, the cost of doing it wrong would be $19 million an hour. I'm concerned that in the implementation of this bill, they might do things such as remove the ability to add tips on a credit card so that a server would not receive a tip unless the patron brought cash and was able to leave cash. I am concerned about the possibility that, you know, this bill, as I understand it, would become law by early fall. And, for example, implementing chips in credit cards, that process took about 5 or 6 years. And I am concerned also that as of now, we would be mandating these changes from the perspective of one state with 0.3% of the United States population. I have lived in Alaska since 1988. I have had 3 children here. 2 have graduated from public schools. The 3rd is going to graduate in a few years. I say this with a heart full of love for Alaska, but I am concerned that if 0.3% of the population of America requires a profound change or enhancement in how credit card payments are processed, that there could be unintended consequences, potentially up to credit card companies geo-blocking Alaska.
Thanks. Okay.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Schmidt, and I can't ask you to speculate, but it's been a long time since I only carried cash. What might be, do you feel comfortable saying what might be the effect on the businesses that would have their ability to access credit card services be? Would they get more business, less business? What might that consequence be for those businesses?
Again, I am getting from an end that this bill, if enacted into law, would require a significant change in how much data is accumulated. And I understand that it might be easy to say, well, it's just how much tax and how much tip. That's data that is not already collected. And again, you're talking about something that's happening 19,000 times an hour in the state of Alaska. The merchants would all need new point-of-sale processing hardware. And you would have to roll something out and have it up and working in months. And again, the downside penalty to the industry, for example, on a $100 charge where the bank earns, you know, whatever it earns, a small amount, there's a $1,000 penalty if they get it wrong. I believe that there is a meaningful risk of reduced ability to use credit cards in the state of Alaska to the detriment of small businesses. I understand profoundly the desire to help small businesses. My first job in 1989 was busing tables at Chepo's Fiesta at the Eagle River. I got paid tips. I get it. I feel I certainly want to benefit Alaska small businesses, and I absolutely want to benefit people who work for tips in the state of Alaska. But I am concerned that making the credit card industry make a profound change in how it gathers data and how it processes payments, and doing it from a position of such a small segment of the population, carry serious downside risks for the very people that this bill is intended to help.
Mr. Schmidt, I think the reason the credit card companies are fighting this so hard is they realize as soon as one state succeeds at this, frankly, all of them are going to do it. So we would not be the only ones, but go ahead, Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Schmidt, Illinois successfully passed this law, although it is being litigated. You certainly laid out a series of very scary circumstances. Have any of those things come to pass in Illinois where they have passed almost an identical law?
If we are to use the guide, it is likely that much of this bill will be halted in federal litigation. If we have also seen in Illinois state chartered financial institutions wanting to seek out federal charters. But the scenario I lay out has not had a chance to happen in Illinois because the law has been delayed and is not taken effect because of the litigation.
Very well. And just to remind members, the effect of state chartered banks seeking federal charter is exactly why we are back here with this bill, considering Amendment N.5. One thing I found, very interesting, if I could, Mr. Co-Chair, is under the original bill, my little bill, nice little bill, Section 3. if you look at Section 3 of the bill, page 4, line 27, page 4, line 27, and I'll read it out here. It says, well, I'll start with 26. A payroll card account must provide an employee at least one cost-free withdrawal each week or pay period, whichever is longer. That means that with this original financial services bill, a pay card, they have differential fees based on when a transaction occurs. That means the credit card companies, the financial services industry, can figure out when to charge fees or not based on when the transaction occurs. I made reference, not lightly, to another bill in the body having to do with transactions regarding firearms and how credit card companies are seeking to put special codes on firearms transactions so that they can deny firearms transactions. Credit card companies, in conversations with me, and I know other members, have made it clear. We've heard, you can call it a threat or a scary scenario, whatever you will, from Director Schmidt that said that they will not allow, maybe, the charging of tips on cards. That would be a separation of a transaction that could be accounted for and marked separately, as some members of the financial industry are already doing and threatening to do more of with the firearm industry, to account for those transactions separately. The industry is already doing this. They have the technology. People are being scared in Alaska because this legislation before us and being considered in other states is going to cost these mega banks and credit card companies money. How much money? A little more than one half of 1% for every transaction. That's real money and real dollars for folks who operate restaurants and bars and collect sales taxes for local governments. It might not be much money for these mega banks and financial services. So I understand the scary rhetoric and different ideas being thrown around. This bill, brought to us by the financial services industry, has in it language that already provides for differential fees. They have the ability, as we've seen in other transactions that these financial services companies find distasteful, to mark those transactions and treat them differently. I see no reason why the industry can also not separate out taxes and tips, treat those transactions separately, and account for them appropriately according to the will of the people of the state of Alaska, to preserve revenue for waitstaff, restaurants, bars, and other businesses that don't need transaction fees charged to taxes and tips. That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there further questions? Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Schmidt, I'm curious to find out what your thoughts might be about the effect of the amendment before us on the operation of your division in banking and securities.
If there is an amendment that I have, if there is an amendment that places a $10 billion or $20 billion threshold on the operation of this bill, it will fundamentally alter the fiscal note.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. That's a in what way, sir?
It would the fiscal impact to the state by virtue of state banks or state credit union not needing to seek shelter in a federal charter to avoid the impact of this bill.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we didn't hear. You got cut off at first. I didn't quite hear what you said, sir. I'm so sorry. You're kicking in a little slow.
If there is a $10 billion or a $20 billion threshold added to this bill, that would remove the incentive to state banks and the state credit union to seek a federal charter, meaning they would stay with the state, which would reduce or potentially eliminate the fiscal impact by virtue of fees and assessments paid to the division.
Eliminate the impact by virtue of the fee. Can you be, is this going to cost the state money or add state money?
We would lose money without the cap because they would become federally chartered. With a cap, we would not lose that money. or we would lose less of it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the clarification.
Yes.
Thank
you. Go ahead, Representative Plum.
Director Schmidt, do you see a fiscal note coming to the additional work that you have to do with this bill?
Give me a moment to think about that question. We do not examine or regulate credit cards directly. We examine an overview. We examine the safety and soundness of the operations of a bank as a whole. We can look at the credit card section of their operations, but we do not have a particular function or staff dedicated to credit card transactions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So based on what members have heard, would they like me to move a conceptual amendment increasing the threshold from 10 to 20? Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going to move conceptual amendment number one to increase 10 million to 20 million on line 5 of amendment in dot 5. Is there objection?
Yeah. I'll object for this purpose of discussion.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little concerned at the fast and furious pace of the work on this bill. We had a bill, a nice, cute little bill. It got a CS, got another CS, got amended, got brought back, got rescinded, got this amendment, got a conceptual amendment. If anyone else's head is spinning, I would not be surprised. And I suspect the public, maybe some of the financial experts in the room, it might be kind of a head spinning. So I guess I'm just concerned at the whip-fast speed with which this legislation is being modified.
And Representative Sadler, I should have acknowledged that Representative Elam is here, and we have had hearings on standalone legislation to address this, too.
Thank you.
Did you want to speak, Representative Elam? Let's take a brief at ease. Let me restate that conceptual amendment to replace 10 billion on line 5 with 20 billion. And Representative Sadler objected. Representative Sadler, do you maintain your objection?
Now that we've clarified that, we're only making a $10 billion change. I will remove my objection.
Okay. The objection is removed, so conceptual amendment 1 passes. With that, Representative Hall, do you have a motion?
I have a question.
Go ahead, Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I don't know if this is for Director Schmidt or who could answer this, but do we know what percentage of transactions are happening through state-chartered banks or credit unions versus national banks? If the intention here is to ensure that we're reducing interchange fees for small businesses, I just want to know what the impact is of excluding the local banks and credit unions, just practically speaking.
Sorry, to whom is that question directed?
Probably to Director Schmidt.
Okay. Go ahead, Director Schmidt. Maybe you could address, in terms of credit cards used by Alaskans, to the extent you know, how many come from sort of the largest banks, which are national banks, versus the smaller Alaska banks.
It is my educated that the substantial majority of credit card transactions in Alaska are performed by very large national banks, such as Bank of America, Citibank, J.P. Morgan, and those sorts of very large banks, and that state-issued credit cards are in the solid minority.
And Representative Carrick, that's my understanding. The national credit card market is essentially an oligopoly where, like, 2 to 3 companies control 80-90% of the market. And they would obviously be affected by this and therefore reap the benefits for small businesses.
I have a question, I think, for you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Actually, so the other concern that came up at a previous hearing was potential impact on purchasing new point-of-sale equipment, which I think was rightfully disputed. But
yeah,
with this bifurcation amendment, mm-hmm, which I do support, is there a software concern that we're worried about with making those transactions possible on the small businesses?
Yeah, so I will address that. I don't think a lot of people are aware that when we walk around a grocery store, companies are tracking literally where we are down to the foot and how long we linger in front of, you know, a box of cereal or whatever it is. So these companies know exactly where we are all the time, and tracking a 20% tip is like the easiest thing in the world compared to surveilling us 100% of the time in our purchases. We have other bills coming up and other committees that some people need to go to So we're going to take action on this bill, and I want to get to the other bills on the committee's agenda today.
Certainly.
Representative Paul?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I have a question. Actually, for you, we heard the concerns expressed by Director Schmidt about that it took five, I think he said 6 years, to have chips in credit cards implemented. So my question to you as the maker of the motion is, do you have any concerns about the speed with which this language, the entire legislative package here, would be implemented in Alaska? Do you have any concerns?
My only concern is that the legal challenges brought by credit card companies will delay the benefits that our small businesses will achieve if we can ultimately deliver this policy. And, yeah, it'll go to litigation, and, you know, hopefully we prevail and small businesses prevail. But the reality is this thing's not going to be implemented in 4 months, even if the bill passes, because it will be litigated. And, again, I hope small businesses prevail in that litigation, and we do.
Chair, just one comment. I think it's important, especially because we do talk about commerce and different industries, that we not malign certain industries and individuals. It's not a good look. We don't know people individually. I just be careful about doing that.
Yep. Okay. Is there further discussion on this bill before we take action? Because we do have some other bills to get to on today's hearing. Okay. Representative Hall.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report SB 79, Work Order 34-LS0494/N out of committee as conceptually amended and amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. I also authorize legislative legal to make technical and conforming changes.
Is there objection?
Yeah.
Representative Sadler, do you wish to comment?
Certainly. I would just simply observe there's been a lot of moving pieces, a lot of quick action. My comments earlier about the public likely being whipsawed by the rapid action and change of this legislation, I think, stands. I hope we do have time to consider the implications of this significant legislation over the interim so we can make a wise decision and not just a fast decision.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Plum.
Yeah. And I think just what Director Schmidt gives me pause to at least think. And we've already caught maybe some unintended consequences. So I like the concept, but I think it's moving pretty fast. So I'm probably going to vote no.
Okay. Robert. Briefities. Back on the record, so we neglected to dispense with adoption of N.5. So do you want to withdraw your motion on the bill and we'll go back to N.5?
Mr. Co-Chair, I withdraw my motion.
Okay, so Amendment N.5 is before us. Is objection to N.5 maintained with a $20 billion threshold as conceptually amended?
I remove my objection. I think it was made.
Okay. Not seeing further objection, N.5 is adopted, bringing us to the underlying bill.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report SB 79, Work Order 34-LS0494/N out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes, with legislative legal having the authority to make technical and conforming changes.
Thank you. And there was objection. So could the Secretary call the roll?
Representative Burke.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Colomb.
No.
Co-Chair Hall.
Yes.
Co-Chair Fields.
Yes.
4 yeas, 3 nays.
So by a vote of 4-3, Senate Bill 79 is reported from committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. We're going to take a brief at ease to transition to the next bill. Okay. Back on the record, thanks to the invited testifiers for sticking around as we go late. Representative Andy Story and her staff are here to present House Bill 184. Would you like to give a brief introduction, and then we'll go to invited testimony?
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. It's good to be here today, and I appreciate you hearing the bill. For the record, I'm Representative Andy Story, serving House District 3, which includes North Juneau, Tehanes, Clequan, Skagway, and Gustavus. It is hard to find a community in Alaska today that is not negatively impacted by a housing shortage. Many developments continue to focus on single-family or higher-priced condo units rather than higher-density developments that could achieve affordability through scale. New workforce housing facilities containing 5 units or more are some of the greatest community needs. I hear from businesses struggling to hire personnel who turned down a job offer in their business because they could not find housing, and from younger adult residents and families here in Juneau making the difficult decision to leave because of the lack of housing. This creates stress for our businesses, and it hinders the growth of our economy. Rental vacancy rates have dramatically decreased in availability, while rent prices have increased. According to the 2023 Alaska Housing Finance Corporation rental market survey of 1,115 units in Juneau, the vacancy rate was 4%. Anything below 5% indicates a tight supply and strong demand, underscoring our housing crunch. Alaska, as you know, needs to build more affordable multi-unit housing. House Bill 184 seeks to help do that through the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority's Loan Participation Program. This bill would expand AIDA's existing program and statute to specify providing various means of financing and means of financing of facilitating the financing of construction of new workforce housing facilities containing 5 units or more would be happening through AIDA. This would help AIDA's goal of developing more industry in Alaska by helping to meet industry's housing needs. Rental housing is workforce housing. AIDA has shown support for this bill. Though AIDA has the capacity, AIDA has not engaged in financing workforce housing for quite some time. House Bill 184 would add clarity and direction under statute while helping to incentivize much-needed multi-unit development. This bill is the House companion to Senator Dunbar's Senate Bill 14. With me today is my legislative aide, Tammy Smith, who is available to walk through the sectional analysis if you would like it. But there is a zero fiscal note attached to this legislation. We do have some invited testifiers online today. If we would like to go to them, I appreciate them being able to hang on.
Let's skip the sectional and go to invited testimony. First up is Sean Debenham. Mr. Debenham, thank you for being with us, and please proceed with your testimony. It looks like Mr. Debenham may not actually be available. Is Ms. Wohl available? Okay. Michelle Brown, can you proceed with your invited testimony, please?
Yes, thank you. Can you hear?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. Co-Chair Field and Hall and members of the committee, I am Michelle Brown with the Housing Alaskans Public-Private Partnership, a housing trust that works to accelerate housing development, and I am testifying in support of House Bill 184. We support the bill to make clear that AIDA has the authority to invest in multifamily housing development projects, and it would open the door for AIDA to explore the wide array of innovative financing tools that other states have deployed with proven results that stimulate housing development. This is not only consistent with AIDA's mission to finance projects that create job opportunities and economic growth, it's necessary to secure the workforce needed to breathe life into any of those major projects that AIDA currently finances. Alaska's housing shortage is stifling economic growth, community stability, and family well-being. It's always cited in business surveys as one of the leading, if not the top, reason why businesses say they cannot grow. One of the major drivers for out-migration is the lack of housing, and it is also a major contributor now to the escalating decline of in-migration rates for our workforce. It's also a cause of shrinking critical community services because safety officers, healthcare workers, teachers, so on cannot find housing. I'm not going to dwell on the housing shortage since you're all well aware of it. Instead, I'd like to focus on how this is an opportunity to help move us out of this problem. Developers are stymied in meeting housing demand because the cost of construction and acquiring capital are too high in today's market, and they cannot pencil projects for what people can afford to pay in rent. Other states have demonstrated that state-level financial tools do stimulate the development of affordable housing by providing access to capital on more favorable terms. By clarifying ADA's authority to finance multifamily housing, ADA could evaluate and implement new finance tools that would help Alaska housing developers. Tools like government-backed loans with lower interest rates, longer-term loans, construction loans, and mezzanine finance that allow developers to fund projects in stages, spreading out the financial burden over time. And as ADA develops these tools, it can partner with banks and public-private housing partnerships that can reduce risk, better coordinate the funding we do have, and share resources. Those are also proven strategies from other states. In short, financing tools will help lower both the upfront and the long-term cost of housing development, making it more feasible for developers to create units for Alaska's workforce. The status quo is not working in today's environment. HB 184 provides some new paths to make more dollars available for housing loans and the flexibility for ADA to design loan terms in consultation with developers and others that would make a meaningful impact on the developer's ability to close the gap between construction costs and what the market can afford to pay in rent. This would encourage more developers to take on multifamily housing production. It would grow the construction sector and associated businesses, and it would open the door for other businesses that now say the housing shortage is impeding their ability to grow and allow them to turn their full attention to business growth rather than the constant search for new workers. While low interest loans, public-private partnerships, and financial risk mitigation strategies, these tools can reduce the financial barriers right now that are causing developers to not build multifamily housing. HB 184 would allow ADA to put some of these tools to work to address Alaska's critical housing shortage. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Okay. Do members have questions for Michelle Brown or the bill sponsor or Mark Davis, who is counsel for ADA? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to the sponsor, Representative Story. ADA, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. I would think that my first thought is housing would be more in the wheelhouse of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. So I'm curious, did you consider trying to house this authority and this kind of program inside Alaska Housing Authority instead of the Industrial Development and Export Authority?
Sure. Through the chair, thank you for that question. In fact, in our last hearings, we've had Ms. Stacey Barnes from HFC on the line, and we did ask her to be here today, but it's gotten late, so that might have to do with it. But they do a lot.
Representative Story, she actually is online.
Oh, thank you. Then perhaps she would be the expert to talk about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Barnes, did you hear Representative Sadler's question?
No, Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Stacey Barnes from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. But could you repeat the question, sir?
Thank you. Yes, through the chair, Ms. Barnes, Dan Sadler here. I'm just curious if I had asked the sponsor if she had considered working with Alaska Housing Finance opposed to Alaska Industrial Development Authority to create worker housing. So I guess my question directly to you might be, does AHFC have any programs or provisions that might help provide workforce housing as this legislation attempts to do?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Sadler. Again, for the record, it's Stacey Barnes from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And about a year ago, Senator Dunbar reached out to our office and shared his concerns about the need for additional housing statewide. We have shared with him that AHFC does currently offer multifamily loan financing. We don't do that on the construction end, but we do it for the long-term financing. And by way of some context, at the last committee that this bill was in, we shared information about the number of multifamily loans in our portfolio in total, and also the activity that we've had over the last couple of years.
Okay, a follow-up, if I may, through the chair to Ms. Barnes. Would it be difficult for AHFC to adapt its as I'll say, system, its programs, its protocols to try and provide financing for construction and not just sale of commercial housing for multifamily housing?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, as it relates to construction financing and AHFC's business model on that, I would feel much more comfortable talking with our mortgage director and our CFO and looking to our statute and getting back to you on that.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Barnes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Sadler, I want to go to Representative Story in a second, but I think at least as I see it, a potential benefit of clarifying that ADA does have this authority is that would be additional resources on top of what AHFC can sustainably invest since they are maximizing their investment under their dividend. Go ahead, Representative Story.
Thank you, through the chair. It's a good question. I think what's so important is ADA does have capital. I think it's it's projects that I think Alaskans would appreciate if ADA did help do workforce housing. And I think it really contributes to their purposes to help the economy get going to meet a need that industry really has. It's one reason why industry is having trouble thriving, whereas they just don't have employee housing.
Yeah, Representative Sadler, if I could just add to that, I mean, what got me thinking about this bill is two mining forums ago, the primary issue of discussion here in Juneau from Greens Creek and Kensington was housing, which I thought was, I mean, it totally surprised me. And I had never thought of housing as baseline economic development, but it reoriented my thinking. Are there further member questions for ADA, AHFC, the bill sponsor?
This could go to ADA or the bill sponsor, maybe. I thought ADA could already do that. Don't they already give loans to?
Through the chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. They can already do that, but they are not doing it. They haven't done it since the 80s. And this is to really put it in statute, make it clear in our last committee of hearing, and we can hear from ADA again, too. They did think that this would help move them in that area. But please feel free to ask ADA that.
Yeah, and let's go to Mr. Davis, if you're available and could hear that question. Do you want to comment on your authority and, you know, maybe why clarifying that would be helpful?
Yeah, for the record, this is Mark Davis with ADA here. It is true that ADA can already provide financing for housing that's associated with a particular employer. And we have done that much more recently than the 80s. For example, we have made loans in Prudhoe Bay for a work camp. And so we do have the ability because our statutes let us work on a project. For example, bonding, that's 0807, and then project is defined as a commercial activity, which is fairly broad and 900 CMD. However, we have also said that this provides clarification that we would have that power.
Thanks.
Okay. Yes, Representative
Sandler. Thank you, Chair. To Mr. Davis, good to hear your voice, sir. Would expansion of ADA's mission to housing in any way detract from its ability to perform its other functions of industrial development and export encouragement?
Representative Sandler, through the chair, I don't think so, because I think a lot of what we'd be looking at with these kinds of programs would be revenue bonds for the larger projects, and those don't really impact ADA's bottom line, but they're actually sold out in the marketplace.
Okay, great. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Not seeing further questions. Thank you, Representative Story, for being here. Next up on the agenda is House Bill 20 by Representative Sadler. Representative Sadler, go ahead.
Switch table. Switch
and table. Sure, you can, however you prefer.
Very good. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Story. And I would note, Lori, Division Insurance Director Lori Winghire is here for questions. Representative Sadler, and Ms. Walter Dang, do you just want to remind us of what this bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Dan Sadler, House District 24. Appreciate the chance to address as well as to participate on the Labor and Commerce Committee. I appreciate bringing up HB 20, which would prohibit fees for paper documents. Real briefly, ladies and gentlemen, this bill would just prevent businesses from charging an extra fee to customers who prefer to get their invoices or their statements or other documents the traditional old-fashioned way on paper through the U.S. mail. I know that more and more phone carriers, utilities, banks are either charging a monthly fee if people want to get paper documents or the other way, offering a discount to go paperless. The challenge, Mr. Chairman, is that not every Alaskan wants to do business online, and frankly, not every Alaskan can do business online. We have 100,000 of us who are 65 years or older who are probably more comfortable doing business on paper and who are likely to stay that way, internet or not. And likely also because these people are on fixed income, likely, they're less likely to be able to afford extra fees to get their stations, their bills. Also, about 60,000, think about that, 60,000 Alaskans have no internet access. And though while another 200,000 do have internet access, it can be slow, below federal minimums, and maybe unreliable. And that's not just, you know, a Bush Alaska thing. Even here in the Capitol, you'll recall that on February 28th, we had a damaged subsea cable that threw us into a tizzy because we did not have internet access. So to wrap up briefly, because of time demands, this bill would bar businesses from charging different rates for customers based on whether they went paperless or went for paper. It doesn't cost the state, imposes no additional cost on businesses, but does recognize the unique challenges we have in Alaska with limited internet access and an aging population. I appreciate your consideration of House Bill 20.
Thanks, Representative Sadler. I think Representative Colom has an amendment. Should we proceed to amendments, given that we're running late?
I move amendment N2.
I'll object. Go ahead, Representative Colom.
So this is an amendment that basically says that insurer may charge a fee to recover up to 90% of the cost of them providing the paper statement. And again, this is a bill telling businesses what they can charge and what fees are appropriate, what's not. I do think it's fair to let them recover some of the cost of printing, mailing statements to people, but this keeps it from being, you know, gouging people. So this basically says they can recoup the cost of doing that, but they can't charge any more than that.
Thank you, Representative Colom. Representative Sadler, do you wish to comment on this proposed amendment?
Yes, I would. I appreciate the thoughtfulness and the desire to protect consumers, business rather. However, I would say that the cost of doing business by paper has been baked into businesses in the United States for decades. So I don't think it's necessarily an additional cost. What we have here, the baseline is paper, and there's savings to businesses to go paperless, certainly after the initial cost for software and so forth. But they're not going to be incurring any additional costs that they might not have been incurring for decades before. Secondly, I'm concerned about how the costs, there's not really a definition of how costs would be established. There would be nothing I see in this amendment language that would bar a company from grossly overestimating the cost of doing the service, and then that being diluted by 20% or 90%, it wouldn't have the effect I think it would like to do. Frankly, the effect of the amendment is to significantly, if not entirely, dilute the intended effect of the bill. So I would respectfully say I'd rather not do this.
Go ahead, Representative Carey.
Thank you, through the chair, to the maker of the amendment, I guess. Is this intended to be? Well, I guess let me phrase the question, then we'll decide who's going to answer. So right now, this legislation is limited to scenarios where you are not charging for issuance of an electronic notification, and it's prohibiting a charge for a paper receipt of that same communication. So is this amendment potentially creating a cost to a person receiving a document that is not, I mean, I get that we're prohibiting fees. I guess I'm trying to figure out, are there scenarios where individuals are receiving electronic copies and paying for things, in which case this amendment would have the intended effect of providing a lower cost?
Yeah.
And I did not phrase that very well. I'm sorry. But I think Representative Sadler might be able to answer it.
I believe I understand the import of the question. In the work and doing research on this bill, I have never come across an instance where a company would charge extra for internet services. Mm-hmm. I think as businesses go more and more modern, I think there's an assumption that that is the way the world's going. And I think it is the way the world's going. Frankly, who this addresses is people who are more reliant on traditional practices, which in years past, the default has been paper. So And I would actually, this might be an opportune time to note that the bill doesn't just prohibit a company from charging an extra fee, it does prohibit them from charging a differential fee, that is, a discount for doing business electronically, which has the same net effect of being, you know, a bit of a penalty on someone who wants to do business by paper. Does that answer your question?
Just a brief follow-up. So if the person issuing a document is charging a fee for receiving any document, whether it's electronic or paper, this isn't the legislation underlying isn't creating a scenario where we are not charging for a paper document when there is a fee existing. Because I think to Representative Klom's point, if the issuance of the document is incurring a charge regardless.
Yeah. To my mind, through the chair, Representative Carey, I don't conceive and have not heard any evidence of a company charging a fee to provide statements and charge bills online. But I'm going to consult my chief of staff, who's done some of the research on my behalf, to see if she can answer that question for you.
Okay. For the record, this is Melody Wilterdink, staff to Representative Dan Sadler. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, I think maybe your question is getting at the opposite. For example, Northern Bank, if you are enrolled in online banking but you want a paper statement, they're going to charge you $2 for it. Is your question perhaps, would the amendment make that amount $1.80?
Well, I suppose I'm just trying to avoid a scenario where we're prohibiting a charge for a paper document where there is a charge for an electronic document that exists already. Like, so if you are charged for an electronic or a paper document, regardless, I don't want to create a scenario where now a business cannot charge if it's a paper document, if that makes sense. So regardless of how you've chosen to receive the communication, if there is a fee that's attached to it, and I hear that maybe they're just that's just not as yeah. is not a concern. Yeah. That there would be a fee attached.
No. Well, through the chair. Okay. No. It says may not charge an additional fee for a paper statement.
Okay. Thank you for that discussion.
Sorry.
I guess I will defer to the bill sponsor and maintain my objection to the amendments. So, not seeing further discussion, will the secretary call the roll?
Representative Colomb.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Burke.
Pass.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Burke.
No.
Co-chair Fields.
No.
One yay, five nays.
So by a vote of 1-5, Amendment Number 1, or N.2, has not passed. I think that was the only amendment we received. So with that, I'm just going to share, Representative Sadler, one of the reasons I support the bill is that as email systems have become worse at filtering email, I think there's a higher odds of missing bill statements and other financial statements online. So I see this as a way of being timely with payments, so that's one of the reasons I support it. I don't want consumers to get penalized with late fees when they never saw an email because Google sent it to the wrong place, which I find is increasingly common. Is there further discussion before taking action on the bill?
Can I just make a comment?
Of course.
Again, there was some disparaging remarks about business owners possibly taking this situation to overcharge people. I'm tired of people talking about business owners in this way, whether it's large companies or small companies. I'm really, really frustrated. This is labor and commerce, not just labor. And so when we are talking about the businesses, whether it's in state or out of state, I would ask that people are more respectful when they speak about them.
Thanks, Representative Klum.
Thanks.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move to report House Bill 20, Work Order 34-LS0237/N out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Not seeing objection. House Bill 20 does pass from committee. Please sign the paperwork. We'll take a brief at ease to turn to the next bill. back on the record. The last order of business is House Bill 145 by Representative Nelson. And staff, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, Representative David Nelson, representing Jay Bear, Government Hill, and East Anchorage. Thank you for the opportunity to hear House Bill 145, an act authorizing mobile sports wagering, relating to the regulation of mobile sports wagering, imposing a tax on mobile sports wagering revenue, relating to criminal history record checks for licensures to operate mobile sports wagering, and providing for an effective date. This bill aims to address three major issues: converting consumers from the black market to the legal market, providing consumer protections, and generating revenue for the state of Alaska. These illegal operators are predatory in nature, offering no consumer protections, age verification, tools to address addiction issues, or guaranteeing payouts, giving consumers zero recourse in the case of problems such as collecting winnings or receiving basic customer service support. These unregulated operators further victimize consumers by offering loans and lines of credit to trap individuals in a debt cycle while generating no benefits to the state. As of March 2025, 39 states have legalized sports wagering, either online or in person. Missouri is the latest of them. House Bill 145 would require operators applying for licenses in the state of Alaska to have and maintain a license in at least three other jurisdictions, which help assure a high standard for the state. Legal operators offer tools such as helplines, links to articles and programs that assist with addiction issues, option to set limits, as well as to opt out temporarily or permanently, and most importantly, strict age and identity verification. These tools offer new support and consumer protections which currently do not exist in the state. Service conducted by the American Gaming Association in 2019 shows that people prefer to wager on the legal market. The top reason for that is that they are confident their bets are going to be paid out at the end of the day. 74% of bettors saying it's important to only bet through legal providers. Legalizing this industry in Alaska would also bring revenue to a state which is currently going to illegal operators. This would not only apply to residents, but also any person physically betting in the state, including tourists and seasonal workers, meaning we won't lose out on revenue from people who are working in the state temporarily. The total tax revenue across all legalized states that this industry has generated since 2018 surpasses $6.7 billion. Alaska needs more diverse sources of revenue, and this is one. Legalizing online sports wagering is a simple solution that would capture a market which already exists in the state. Everyday people are betting in the state using illegal means, leaving them vulnerable to exploitation while generating no fiscal benefit to the state of Alaska. House Bill 145 would offer protections and oversights to the residents of the state, tourists, and seasonal workers traveling to Alaska. I'm looking forward to working with fellow legislators on future amendments so we can guarantee high standard of consumer safety and satisfaction across the gaming industry in the state. It's time we join 39 other states in this thriving market. Either it's the will of this committee, I can have my staff, Bogdan Gamilkov, read the sectional analysis, or we can just move to invited testimony, whichever.
We're going to go to invited testimony because I misspoke when I said that was the last item on the agenda. We do have one more item from Representative Tomaszewski, so let's go through invited testimony and then make sure we get through the whole agenda. First up is Matt Scalf with DraftKings. Go ahead, Mr. Scalf.
Oh, you don't have a line already?
Try again, Mr. Scalf.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Team chat.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, can we take a quick at ease real quick?
We can hear you, Mr. Scalf, but we're going to take a brief at ease and be right back. Back on the record, and we do have three invited testifiers, and I would ask them to be efficient so we can get through this and finish the last bill on the agenda. So go ahead, Mr. Scalf.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Co-chairs Fields and Hall and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Matt Scalf, Government Affairs Manager for DraftKings, and I'm here to provide testimony on behalf of DraftKings in support of HB 145 relating to mobile sports wagering. We appreciate the opportunity to participate in today's hearing to discuss the legislature's consideration of authorizing a competitive, regulated, fully mobile sports wagering market. DraftKings Incorporated is a digital sports entertainment and gaming company with products that range across daily fantasy, regulated gaming, and digital media. Headquartered in Boston and launched in 2012, DraftKings is the only U.S.-based vertically integrated sports wagering operator. DraftKings Sportsbook is live with mobile and or retail sports betting operations pursuant to regulations in 28 states, Washington, D.C., and Ontario, Canada. DraftKings is committed to being a responsible steward of this new era in real money gaming by developing and promoting educational information and tools to help all players enjoy our games responsibly. DraftKings supports a sports wagering framework in Alaska that protects players, generates revenue for the state, and stamps out the pervasive illegal market. It is important to recognize that sports wagering is already taking place in Alaska, with an estimated $139 million in illegal wagers placed each year. Nearly all the sports wagers in Alaska are placed online through websites in the robust illegal market, where sophisticated illegal operators capitalize on the popularity of this form of entertainment. Across the country, states are bringing this activity into a legal regulated market that mandates robust player protections. To date, 39 states plus D.C. and Puerto Rico have legalized sports wagering, including 33 jurisdictions which have authorized mobile sports wagering, allowing players to place bets conveniently and safely from their mobile phones and other devices. If the legislature were to move forward with authorizing sports wagering in Alaska, millions in tax revenue would be generated for the state. In addition to benefiting from more financial resources for the state, Alaska residents would be able to choose from a variety of regulated, competitive, and innovative sports wagering products. These products include robust problem gaming resources and player protections that are not available on illegal platforms. Regulated operators like DraftKings and other members of the Sports Betting Alliance take seriously the issues of underage wagering and problem gaming. At DraftKings, we use Know Your Customer technology to ensure underage individuals are not able to create an account, deposit, or wager through our website or application. When verifying a player's identification, a check is conducted using demographic information, including first name, last name, physical address, date of birth, social security number, and geolocation of the player. The verification process is facilitated using multiple vendors, and only upon successful verification is the player able to create an account. DraftKings works with leading companies to monitor users' location through cell phone data and other means. Additionally, for the small segment of the population that requires additional responsible gaming resources, we provide safeguards that allow players to set their own deposit and play limits and to self-exclude from participation should they choose. A player has access to their transaction history available to them in their account information. The account history provides detailed information regarding all wagers placed, all winnings and losses, and summary of their play over the last month, 3 months, year, and lifetime. Finally, it is important to note that sports wagering would be complementary to gaming currently regulated in Alaska, like charitable gaming, and additive for overall state revenue. Sports wagering is a fundamentally different product from the pull tabs, bingo games, and raffles currently operated under the state's charitable gaming framework. Differences in player demographics support this notion, with research showing that sports wagering attracts younger, affluent, and highly educated players. In New Hampshire and Virginia, states with both charitable gaming and sports wagering, revenue from charitable gaming has continued to increase over time, and the markets for both game types are growing side by side. Also, and importantly, as I've previously mentioned, sports wagering is already taking place in Alaska in the illegal market without player protections or responsible gaming tools or resources. DraftKings appreciates the opportunity to comment on HB 145 today. We're happy to be a resource to the committee as it considers the legislation and any potential amendments that may be suggested by the regulated sports wagering industry or other parties as the process moves forward. I've also submitted a separate presentation to the committee featuring screenshots of the DraftKings app to demonstrate our player identity verification and responsible gaming features, I'd be happy to run through that presentation at the discretion of the co-chairs and time permitting, though I know we're running a bit late today. So I'll otherwise answer any questions you may have. Thank you for your time.
We're going to proceed to the next invited testifier because we're running quite late. Next up is John Pappas. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, and thank you, co-chairs Fields and Hall, distinguished members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is John Pappas, and I serve as the senior advisor to GeoComply. For those who may not be familiar, GeoComply are the global leaders in geocompliance and anti-fraud solutions, and we work with all of the major sports betting and online gaming brands in the United States to ensure that they can offer it in a safe and compliant manner that adheres to all federal and state regulations. We are an approved geolocation provider in every jurisdiction that regulates online sports betting, and our systems are validated by government bodies and independent gaming laboratories alike. Daily, we manage up to 30 million geolocation checks every single day. And our sophisticated technology doesn't simply just check single data source. It is a very robust, multi-layered approach incorporating Wi-Fi, GPS, cell tower triangulation, IP data, and Bluetooth signals to verify a player's exact location. Our platform also detects spoofing technology such as VPNs, proxy servers, remote desktops, virtual machines, as well as going down to the device level to ensure that the devices themselves haven't been manipulated or tampered with. However, today I want to stress some of the data that we've seen that indicates a strong consumer demand for legalized sports betting in Alaska, and maybe some of the unique challenges that the state would face given its vast geography and the maritime borders. From January 1st, 2024 through May 1st, 2025, our company identified 126,933 geolocation checks from devices located within Alaska attempting to access legal sports books in other states. Of course, our technology identified that this was coming from an impermissible jurisdiction, and therefore it was blocked. And during this time, we also identified over 20,300 unique mobile sports betting accounts within the state of Alaska. These figures represent a remarkable 60% increase in accounts over the year prior, clearly demonstrating a substantial and growing consumer demand within the state for safe and regulated betting options. Alaska, as you guys know, has a wonderful and extraordinary geography with thousands of miles of coastline and proximity to international borders with Canada and Russia. So we believe precise geolocation technology becomes not only beneficial but essential. We want to make sure that we can verify users wherever they are in the state, but also on the maritime boundaries. In some of the presented data that we sent ahead of time, we showed some an example of this compliance that we were doing in the coast of Brazil, where we used sophisticated geolocation methods to distinguish permissible bets from impermissible bets just off the coast of Brazil. So even in the waters, we're able to identify permissible wagers, but those outside of the legal permissible boundary there, we're able to exclude those. And we believe we need to apply the same type of capability to Alaska, given the volume of cruise ships, boating, and other maritime traffic along the Alaskan coast. We're going to look forward to collaborating closely with operators and state regulators to make sure that there's a compliance framework that works for the state and it's tailored to your geography. This ensures that all wagers are accurately captured from the permissible areas, and then they're blocked from those where they're not. And our goal is to do create compliance without, you know, sacrificing the user experience. So in conclusion, we stand ready to work with you as lawmakers and as regulators as this market unfolds. Our data has shown that there is tremendous demand for legal betting options in the state. And we want to be a resource to this committee as you move forward on this legislation. And a special thank you to Representative Nelson for inviting us here today.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Pappas. Final invited testifier, Kevin Winters. Go ahead, Mr. Winters, and let's wrap up wrap this up by 5:55 so we can turn to our final piece of legislation. Thank you.
Sure. Chair and distinguished members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Kevin Winters, and I represent Almond Digital Health, a company dedicated to promoting healthy gambling habit practices in the United States. We're here in support of House Bill 145 with a respectful request that the bill be expanded to include explicit and protected funds to address the research, prevention, treatment and aftercare of gambling-related harm. This legislation, which seeks to regulate mobile sports wagering in Alaska, is a significant step forward toward protecting consumers and ensuring that gaming activities contribute positively to the state's economy. Currently, Alaskans are gambling. The issue is it's happening primarily through illegal, unregulated operators. Legalizing and regulating mobile sports wagering allows for consumer protections that are currently unavailable in Alaska. These include things like entity and age verification, self-exclusion protocols, and embedded resources to intervene when someone is showing signs of harm. Alaska is currently one of just 8 states in the country that does not allocate public funding for problem gambling. This is concerning, particularly given the opportunity to proactively address harms as part of this legislation. With dedicated funding and regulation, Alaska can move from reactive to preventive. At Almond, we specialize in delivering digital low-barrier support directly within gaming environments. We work in partnership with gaming operators and public health agencies in other states to ensure responsible play and rapid access to care. Almond is already serving individuals in remote areas in parts of the US, places with similar challenges around access. The model works and ensures that people can get help without waiting weeks or needing to travel hundreds of miles for care. By passing and expanding H. Bill 145 to include explicit funding for problem gambling services, Alaska has the opportunity to regulate a market that already exists, reclaim lost tax revenue, and provide meaningful help to those who need it where they need it most. We at Almond are ready to support the state in implementing these measures effectively. Thanks for your time and consideration.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Sadler, we're actually going to go to the next bill just because we're running very late. So thank you again, Representative Nelson. Next up is Representative Tomaszewski, the actual last time on the agenda, House Bill 197. Go ahead, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Chair Fields, and the members of Labor and Commerce Committee for hearing House Bill 197, Board of Dental Examiners. For the record, my name is Representative Frank Tomaszewski, District 34, the Greater Fairbanks area. Thank you all for hearing this bill. The Board of Dental Examiners requests support for a bill that makes 3 key updates to Alaska's dental regulations. First, to modernize oversight. Second, to expand care access. And third, to improve legal compliance. These proposals are practical, widely supported, and modeled on standards used by other state boards. The bill establishes a dedicated executive administrator for the dental board to improve efficiency, streamline application processing, and let board members focus on high-level issues. This position, housed in the Department of Commerce, will be a partially exempt under state personnel laws. Currently, the law defines who can legally own a practice but lacks enforcement. The bill allows the board to issue penalties to unauthorized owners, ensuring compliance. It also updates outdated licensure requirements for dental hygienists by removing the minimum 2-year program length while still requiring the commission of dental accreditation. The bill broadens eligibility to graduates of accredited accelerated programs without compromising quality. Together, these changes strengthen Alaska's dental system through better administration, compliance, and workforce access. Now, if it is the will of the committee, my staff, Connor Mariner, will give a short presentation, including the sectional analysis.
You know what, Representative Tomaszewski, because we have some people online, why don't we skip the sectional and go straight to invited and public testimony?
Sounds great.
Okay. So first up in invited testimony is Dr. Greg Johnson. Actually, it looks like Mr. Johnson is unavailable. However, we do have some people online for public testimony. So I'm just going to take that public testimony since it's getting late. I'm going to open public testimony. There is no one in the room for public testimony. However, I do see online Lisa Wells. Ms. Wells, please proceed with your public testimony.
Good evening, Co-Chairs Hall and Fields, and to the other LNC committee members. My name is Lisa Wells. I've been a hygienist in Anchorage for 20 years, and I am the current president of the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association. I'm speaking on behalf of myself and on behalf of the 123 members of the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association. While we agree with some of HB 197, we are in opposition to the change proposed regarding the length of dental hygiene education, in which the language, quote, of at least 2 years' duration, end quote, is removed. Alaska hygienists are well-trained and competent healthcare providers that work under the general supervision of a dentist. This allows them to work in areas where the public has limited access to a dentist. Because of our unique situation in the state with many underserved areas, we want to maintain the educational standards for dental hygiene. According to the Commission on Dental Accreditation website, CODA, they monitor the licensure requirements in the USA and Canada. There's a relationship between CODA and the governing entities where everyone is trying to keep on the same page. If the state decides to cede all responsibility to a third party, essentially saying, yeah, whatever you do is fine, then what's the point of even having a statute at all? The examining boards are also third parties. They can make changes. Right now, CODA and the examining boards are all on the same page, but they could change. Alaska statutes are there to protect the public. I'm all for getting rid of red tape and making it easier for hygienists to move to the state, but not at the expense of removing specific educational standards. Anecdotally speaking, when continuing education speakers come to Alaska and ask, who's doing oral cancer screenings at every appointment? Who's exploring for refractory calculus at every appointment? Who's screening for eating disorders or diabetes? We all look around confused because we all are. Is it everyone? And it turns out, no. And these out-of-state guest speakers are impressed. I've heard time and time again, wow, not all states do that. You guys are really good up here. Alaskans should be proud that they have a really well-trained, well-educated workforce, and the state of Alaska should back that up by accepting the amendment we've proposed, which is language straight from the Commission on Dental Accreditation standard. Quote, with curriculum that includes at least 2 academic years of full-time instruction or its equivalent at the post-secondary college level. By accepting this amendment, this clarifies that Alaska will accept programs that may be on an accelerated path, like an 18-month straight snow break, while also maintaining the educational standard that Alaska has had for decades. Also, in reviewing HB 197, we recommend the committee amend the section to read, has successfully passed a state or regional or national dental hygiene clinical examination. On August 1st, 2022, the 3 largest regional examining boards combined to create a national exam, and the statute should reflect this. Thank you for your time and consideration. It's been a pleasure being here and being part of the legislative process.
Thank you, Ms. Wells, and sorry this meeting has run so late. Next up in public testimony is Carrie Schamberger. Go ahead, Ms. Schamberger.
Thank you very much, committee and chairs Hall and Fields and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Dr. Carrie Schamberger. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on this proposed amendment. I'm speaking today as a licensed dental hygienist in the state of Alaska for over 30 years and as the vice president of the Dental Hygienists Association and as an educator in the field of dental hygiene. I have a deep commitment to the public health and education of the students I teach. My testimony reflects on my views, experience of 18 years in dental hygiene education. The requirement for academic program of at least 2 years duration aligns with the Commission of Dental Accreditation, or CODA, which sets the national standard for dental hygiene education and mandates a minimum of 2 full academic years of instruction and supervised clinical experience to ensure safe, competent, and ethical practice. As an educator, I am, again, deeply committed to preserving the depth and breadth of dental hygiene education here in Alaska, ensuring that students are fully equipped to meet the needs of our communities with competence and compassion. dental hygienists in the state of Alaska routinely provide services such as anesthesia administration, radiographic interpretation, periodontal therapy, and disease risk assessment. These are clinical competencies that demand in-depth education and practical training. Dental hygienists often work independently in schools, private, clinical, and public practices, also in rural clinics. These settings require clinical judgment and the ability to work without direct supervision. A minimum of 2 years educational foundation supports this level of responsibility and ensures equitable healthcare delivery. There is only one CODA-accredited dental hygiene program within the state of Alaska, and it plays a vital role in preparing qualified dental hygienists who serve committees across the state, particularly in unserved and rural regions. Weakening educational standards may encourage prospective students to seek out out-of-state programs, draining their local talent. Increase the risk of the state's hygiene educational program and its longevity, and worsening the already challenged workforce shortages by reducing the pipeline of locally trained and competent dental hygienists. The continued success of education of dental hygienists within Alaska depends on the strong support of dental community across Alaska. The dentists, the dental hygienists, and the professional organization enrich student learning through clinical placements and mentorship, reinforces the shared responsibility we have to ensure competent, well-prepared oral healthcare workers. I urge this committee to consider the amendment to the standard to state with curriculum that includes at least 2 academic years of full-time instruction or its equivalent at the post-secondary college level. This language safeguards public health, upholds professional standards, and reinforces Alaska's commitment to educating and retaining high-quality oral health care. Thank you for your time and thoughtful consideration.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Schamberger. Last up in public testimony is Gail Walden. Go ahead, Ms. Walden.
Hello. Thank you, Representative Fields and members of the committee. My name is Gail Walden. I have been a dental hygienist in Alaska since 2003. First, I would like to express my frustration at trying to gather information about this bill from the Board of Dental Examiners. Recent meeting minutes are not available. Also, their last meeting was canceled and their next meeting date is unknown. This lack of information from the board is unacceptable and is no doubt one of the reasons HB 197 seeks to establish an executive administrator. While I do not disagree with the board's intent to establish an executive administrator, I do disagree and oppose the board attempting to remove language from Section 0832.014 that pertains to dental hygienists. To give the committee some history, the dental hygiene statute as currently written went into effect when it was signed by Governor Parnell in May of 2012. Prior to that, the statute read at least a 2-year course. I was on the committee in 2011 along with other hygienists and dentists that reviewed all dental statutes. During that process, the wording was changed to at least 2 years duration. The intent of the change was to align with the Commission on Dental Accreditation Standards that currently states and has stated for a very long time that dental hygiene curriculum must include at least 2 academic years of full-time instruction or its equivalent. The board is misleading legislators. To be clear, no dental hygiene applications have been denied based on this statute. The statute is not outdated. It is accurate. 2 years duration refers to academic years and includes those accelerated programs where dental hygiene students graduate with an associate's degree. Whereas the board proposes to remove the language, I, along with other hygienists in Alaska, want it strengthened or left alone. The Commission on Dental Accreditation Standards are clear, and the statute should reinforce that language. As you know well, statutes are not easily changed and require debate and engagement with legislators. While this can make the process slow and challenging, it also serves as a safeguard. The fact is, hygienists are a minority at the table. There are 9 members on the Board of Dental Examiners, 2 are hygienists. The Commission on Dental Accreditation has 33 representatives. 1 of them is a hygienist.
keeping our educational requirements in statute not only safeguards our professional standards, but provides the public with assurance that competent dental hygienists are being licensed in Alaska. The Board of Dental Examiners exists to protect the public to ensure that all dental providers meet certain standards. Why would they want to remove the language that supports their mission and is accurate? I find that concerning, and you should as well. In conclusion, I ask that you consider the facts that we have presented today and request your support to keep at least 2 years' duration in statute or strengthen it as proposed by the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association. Thank you for considering my testimony today. I condensed it, but I did submit my full testimony in writing to the Labor and Commerce email. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ms. Walden. So with that, public testimony is closed. Any closing questions? And we're going to have to return this bill next year, obviously. So, and do people want to ask questions now or next year?
Can I just ask one question that seems obvious?
Go for it,
Representative
Klum.
I just want to talk to the sponsor about, I mean, all the public testimony is by one sentence on the first page. So did that, taking out the two-year duration, where did that come from? Who recommended that? Do we know? Or why is that important, I guess?
So thank you for the record, Representative Frank Tomaszewski. So I heard very little from any dental hygienist about this bill other than today. This has been the most communication I've had. Okay. I think there was a phone call asking about it, but no real questions. So this would have come from the board, apparently, and my staff can maybe explain a little more.
Yeah, for the record, Connor Mariner, I'm staff to Representative Tomaszewski. The Board of Dental Examiners requested this change in order to increase the efficiency of approving dental hygienist licenses. It takes a lot of vetting in order to prove that they spent 2 years getting education in the field post-secondary.
All right. Well, we will return to this bill next year. So I hope this is our last meeting of this session. So thanks for everyone's collaboration. And at 6:09, House Labor and Commerce is adjourned.